Abraham's journey of faith. So if you will open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 4, we'll get to that in a second. First of all, I want to ask you all a question that you can think about while you're turning there. And you don't have to actually answer this, don't want to show of hands or anything, just think about this. Have you ever moved? It's a pretty simple question, yes or no. Have you ever moved? Some of you may not have ever really moved large distances from where you grew up at. Some of you may have moved multiple times. In 14 years, I've moved twice. We moved from Butler to Faraday and then from Faraday to here. And to show you where I'm going from this, we'll get into my first point about how Abram obeyed God in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 and 4. Now let's read that. Chapter 12, verses 1 and 4. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you." Verse 4. So Abram went as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. He moved from Haran at the age of 75. And before this, as far as we know, he has only moved once. Can you imagine? And I know some of you have probably not moved at all, really. But only moving twice in 75 years, considering that I've moved twice in 15 years. If I keep that up, by the time I'm 30, I will have moved 4 times. By the time I'm 45, I will have moved 6 times. By the time I get to be 75, I will have moved a lot more than twice if I keep this rate up. So it's kind of surprising to me, especially considering in this society we're always rushing around, we're always moving from one place to another really quickly because there's something that we've got to do, something that we've just got to get to next. And to only have really moved to two different major places in 75 years is it's just kind of amazing to me. Let's also look at Genesis 12:9 and 13:1 to see some of the other places that he's gone through here. Genesis 12:9 and chapter 13, verse 1. And Abram journeyed on, still going toward the Negev, and 13:1. So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had, and Lot with him into the Negev. So I've got a map here. And when I was working through this, I decided, you know, we've got all these lines up here on this map showing Abram and his journey and everywhere that he went. How far, a rough guess, how far is that really? So I found one that had a graph and measurements on it and stuff. Measured out rough estimate about how far he traveled. Abram's journey from Ur to Egypt was around 1,200 miles long. Now think about this for a second. 75 years old, out in the wilderness, no cars, no bicycle, either on foot or on donkey or camel. Have you ever ridden on donkey, camel, horseback? It's nowhere near as pleasant as a car. You do not have air conditioning. The ride's pretty bumpy a lot of the times, too. And through the wilderness at 75 years old, you see later on he had lots of possessions that he took with him as well. Over 300 servants, cattle, silver, gold. He had to keep track of his livestock on this journey. At night, you can see there's a large gap over here where there aren't all that many cities, and traveling through there, he would have had to stop and pitch camp at the middle of the night in the wilderness where there were all sorts of dangers. You would have had wild animals that could have attacked his family, his flocks. You would have had robbers that would have tried to steal some of his things. He had to defend from all of this. And he would have known this But he still had enough faith in God to do what God asked, and he left. And here's the really strange thing about this. God didn't say, okay, yep, here's your roadmap. You go up here, you take a left here, you go right there, you just kind of go down, you go around into Egypt, then you come back out, and yep, then you're good. He didn't say that. He just said, you get up and leave, and I'll tell you where to go. I'll show you where you need to be going. How many of us nowadays would do that? How many of us, if somebody we knew came to us and said, okay, if you just kind of like walk outside your house and just start walking, you got me on the phone and I'll just kind of give you directions on where to go. Just you walk there, and when you get there, I'll give you the house that's at the directions that I'm giving you here. How many of us would do that? Well, first of all, since we would never seen it, we wouldn't know what the house looked like. It could be a rundown trailer out in the woods. And who would want that? Now, we know God's not going to trick Abram like that, but still. So we've seen some of the difficulties that he's gone through already with the map. Let's look at my second point, some more difficulties that Abram is going to encounter. Genesis chapter 12 still, verses 10 through 13. 10 through 13 of Genesis chapter 12. We're going to see just a few more difficulties that he runs into. Now there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. When he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai his wife, I know that you are a woman beautiful in appearance, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but they will let you live. Say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake. So here we can see two problems come up. The first one, Abram really had nothing to do with. He wasn't involved with this one at all. And the first problem is that there's a famine. It's a natural famine. We don't know what caused this. It could have been drought, could have been a plague on livestock or crops, but whatever happened, there's not enough food in the land. But there is food down in Egypt. So Abram hears about this and he's like, okay, we're going down to Egypt. Problem solved. Yay! And then he makes another problem. And what exactly is that problem? Well, I'll give you a hint. Lying to an entire nation isn't a good idea. It's not. Because, you see, if you lie to one person, it's kind of likely that they're going to, at some point down the road, find out that you lied to them, and they're going to be upset about that. If you lie to an entire nation of thousands or millions of people, yeah, they're going to be really upset at you. And that's what he did. He said, okay, this is my sister. Now, that wasn't a total lie, because Sarah, was actually his half-sister that he was married to. Kind of weird, I know, but they had different laws back then. So the lying wasn't really a good idea. And can you kind of understand where he's coming from? I mean, yeah, look at her. I mean, I know the picture's a bit distorted, but we can tell that she was a pretty lady, wasn't she? And you can kind of understand how he might be worried, but to go this far is just, it doesn't make all that much sense, especially since we know that God was going to protect him anyway. It's kind of like, have you ever had somebody that does something like this, where they ask for your advice with a problem, and you've had this problem, you've gone through this before, maybe with a certain person, and you know the exact steps to take, and if you take these steps, if you do this, this, and this, you'll get out fine, you won't have any problems with this ever again. And so you tell them that, and you say, okay, if you do this, this, and this, you're going to be fine. If you just trust me and do these things, if you have faith that what I'm telling you is right, and you do this, then you're going to be all right. And they may listen to you, and then they go off, And instead, they decide, okay, I've got this giant brick wall of a problem. Somebody's told me that there's a door wide open over here. Instead, you know what? If I run fast enough, I can run straight through the brick wall instead of taking the door over there. And to me, that kind of seems what Abram was doing, is that God says, okay, if you have faith in me, if you trust me, I've made this promise with you that I'm going to give you this stuff. I can't give that to you if you're dead, so I'm not going to let them hurt you. So trust me. Don't lie. It's all going to be all right. But Abram instead says, okay, God, yeah, I see you've got this door for me over here. I'm going to run through the wall. How many of y'all, we got brick walls outside. How many of y'all ran through the brick wall of the church building to get in here today instead of taking the door? Huh? It's just not a good plan. You would have some serious injuries from that. So, looking at some more difficulties that he's going to have, Genesis chapter 13, verses 8 and 9, chapter 14, verses 11 through 15, and this is a rather large segment, so I'm not going to read all of it. Basically, I'm going to summarize. In chapter 13 there, those verses, Lot and Abram's shepherds are kind of fighting, and they get together and say, all right, we can't have this. We're both peaceful, we're kin, we're family. We can't have our servants fighting with each other like this. So Abram says to Lot, let's split up. There's good land over here, there's wilderness over here. You take first pick. Wherever you go, I'll go in the opposite direction. And it's a pretty fair guess that Abram knew Lot was going to take the good land. Because, I mean, what would any of us done in that situation? We would have taken the good land, wouldn't we? If we're totally honest, we would have taken the good land, wouldn't we? So Lot takes the good land. It's green and lush, and it's got the rivers and lakes and everything. Plenty of food for all his flocks and servants. And then Abram, true to his word, goes off into the wilderness. And then Lot and his family, along with the cities they were staying in, kind of get taken captive. So Abram has to go save his nephew's butt, basically, which he does very, very admirably with his own trained army of 318 fighting soldiers. Isn't it really cool that he had his own personal army? And maybe that's just 15-year-old's perspective, but I mean, wouldn't it be fun to have your own personal army? Yeah. No. No. Fine. Sorry. Alright, so we've looked at some of the physical things. Let's move more into the spiritual side of things about God's covenant with Abraham. Genesis chapter 12, we're going back to the beginning here, and verses 1 through 3. Last time we were over here, we just did verses 1 and 4, skipped verses 2 and 3. We're going to read 2 and 3 now, because they've got some pretty important stuff in them. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the nations of the earth will be blessed. So this is sort of God's promise, God's covenant with Abram. And there are two different types of promises. You've got an unconditional promise, which is basically like God's love for us. It's unconditional. No matter what, he's going to love us. That's his promise. The other type of promise is set up a bit differently. It's an if-then sort of thing. Basically, the way it works is, if you do this, then I'll do this. And that's what God has going here. So, what does Abram have to do first to get the reward, to get the then? Well, if you see the very first verse, if you go where I will lead you. If you go where I will lead you, then what? What happens? Well, that's verses 2 and 3. You'll get promised land, you'll become a great nation, and if someone blesses you, I'll bless them. Through you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. But see, that's not going to happen unless you leave your father's house and go where I lead you. So it's very important that you do this, because otherwise none of the rest of it's going to happen. So you need to do that. And it's interesting the way the promise kind of works there, set up like that. I also saw something interesting when I was reading through on Abram and Abraham working on this lesson. I saw in Genesis chapter 17, if you want to turn over there real quick, Genesis chapter 17, verses 3 through 5. And I thought this was interesting. Part of this is kind of opinional, so you can take it with a grain of salt, or 100. Okay, or an entire store full of salt. It doesn't matter to me, really. But I'm going to tell you. So let's read this here, 3 through 5 of chapter 17. Then Abram fell on his face, and God said to him, "Behold, my covenant, my promise, is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations." I was reading this, and I was thinking, why does God do this? I mean, it kind of seems totally random, doesn't it? Just like, out of the blue, God's like, "Abram, I'm going to change your name." Why? Just felt like doing it one day, you know. Just, you know, kind of felt like changing your name. So I was thinking, why does God do this? I mean, it does give the reason, "I'm not going to call you this, because I have made you the father of a multitude of nations." But why, still, why is he doing this? And so I was thinking about it, and something just kind of occurred to me. Nowadays, today, if we're going to remind ourselves of something, how do we do it? We've got sticky notes you can stick up on a wall. You've got magnets that have got various different notes and stuff on them you can put in your refrigerator. You've got notifications you can put on all your smartphones and stuff. You can ask a friend or somebody you know to text you or call you at a certain time so you remember to do this right then. But back then, they didn't have all that. They didn't have the sticky notes. They didn't have the smartphones. They could have asked someone to tell them something, but they couldn't have done it long distance, really. So how would they remind themselves of something? How would they do that? Memorials, sort of. And when they're building up all these pillars of rock, when Israel's going into the promised land, that's what they're doing, is they're setting up reminders for themselves. But why would God change his name here? Might I suggest it's because it would create a constant reminder for Abraham of what God had promised him? Let me give you an example here. If God came to you one day and he said, "All right, Bobby, I'm going to make you the greatest scientific mind the world has ever known. I'm going to do this for you. It's going to be great. You're going to win. prizes all over the place. You're going to make discoveries. You will be the greatest scientific mind the world has ever known. You'll be an amazing scientist. And you know what? I'm going to change your name from Bobby to Jim. We're just not, it's pretty simple. Bobby to Jim. Really simple. And if you went by that, you started going by Jim instead of by Bobby, then every time someone called you, said, "Hey Jim, we need some help with this," what would be going through your mind? Well, the first thing that I think of is you think, "Hang on, Jim, my name's not Jim, I'm Bobby." Oh, right. God promised me that he was going to do this, and in the same time, he changed my name. And he promised me that, and he's God, he's not going to lie. He's going to make me an amazing scientist. All that from a name change. And think about it, can't you just kind of see it happening in Abraham's camp? One of his servants calls him and says, "Hey Abraham, we need some help with the cattle." And he says, "Hang on, I'm Abram. Who's this Abram?" Right. God made a promise with me and he changed my name. And all this that he's done for me, I'm never going to forget that. And again, it is kind of opinional because the Bible doesn't specifically say that that's what God was doing. But considering how many times throughout the scriptures God has done something that has had multiple purposes, I think it's fairly likely. I'll leave that up for you. We've already looked at this a little bit, but let's look at this a little bit more in depth. How God has blessed Abraham, both physically and spiritually. So let's look at the physically first. Now, Genesis chapter 13, verse 2. Turn over there, if you will. While you're turning there, I'm going to read chapter 14, verse 1. Now, Abraham was old, well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. Now, Genesis chapter 13, verse 2. Now, Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. What jumps out at you there? Well, we can see that Abram was very rich in multiple different things. He had a lot of livestock, sheep, cattle, donkeys, camels. He had a lot of gold and a lot of silver. He was blessed in all things. But you know what it doesn't say? It doesn't say how much he had. It doesn't say, you know, Abram, he was so rich, he had enough gold to entirely recreate the pyramids of Egypt out of solid gold. That's how much gold he had. He had enough silver to create a monument the size of Mount Everest. He had enough cattle to feed all the people of the world and still have some left over. It doesn't say all that. It doesn't say he had 9,000 pieces of gold or 10,000 pieces of silver or 20,000 cattle. Why doesn't it give us numbers? I mean, would it have been really all that hard for God to supply numbers for these things? Of course not. He's God. So why don't we have numbers for this? Maybe it's because it doesn't matter. Maybe it's because despite all the riches and everything that Abraham and his family were blessed with, it's because he had something more important, something that couldn't be counted or numbered or weighed or measured in any real way. What would that be, though? I mean, you can understand having something amazingly more value than anyone else would suppose, with sentimental value behind something. But what would that be for Abraham? Did some looking around, found out that he's also in the New Testament. So if you want, turn over to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 8 through 10. We're done in Genesis now, by the way. Won't be going back there. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 8 through 10. This is commonly known as the Faith Hall of Fame chapter, and guess who's in there? Yeah, Abraham was. Tells you something about his faith, doesn't it? That it was so great, he got in the Hall of Fame. So let's read this real quickly. 8 through 10. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance, and he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. What city has God designed and built? Heaven, isn't it? That's the only real one. So what does this appear to be saying here? I mean, is this saying Abraham, he was looking for heaven? Hang on. It's kind of surprising. But that's not everything. Matthew 8:11. Matthew 8:11. There we go. Matthew 8:11 reads, I tell you, many will come from east and west and recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. So from Hebrews chapter 11, we learn Abraham was searching for heaven. In Matthew, we learn he found it. He got in. And the really great part about this in Matthew is, guess who's talking here? It's Jesus. And you know he's not going to lie. Jesus is talking, so this has to be the truth. Abraham was searching for heaven. He found it. He got into heaven. And not only him. It says they'll recline a table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So, he wasn't the only one that found it and got in. Pretty much his whole son, his son and grandson, both got in as well. Maybe that's the treasure. Maybe that's the thing that made everything else not matter. Maybe that was it. And as hard as I try, I can't wrap my head around the fact that so far before Jesus was even born onto this earth, you had someone like Abraham and his family not only looking for heaven, but finding it. And of course, you can't physically find it. It's not a physical place. But through his journey, he found it. And maybe what God promised him, the land God promised him, if he trusted God, wasn't a physical place. Maybe that's why God didn't give him directions. Maybe that's why God said, that's why God didn't say, okay, you go up here, you take a left here, you go right here, and you'll be where you need to be going. Maybe that's why he didn't say that, is because you can't really get directions like that to heaven. It's a spiritual journey more of than a physical one, isn't it? One last thing. Zig Ziglar said, if you aim at nothing, you'll hit it every time. Hell isn't nothing. It's like a vacuum. A black hole. Sucks everything it can into it through the power of sin. And not only do you have to not aim at it, you have to aim as far away in the opposite direction as possible with all the strength, all the force, all the willpower that you can muster to break its grasp. And let me tell you something that might seem sad here. It won't be enough. All the power, all the strength of mind, all the force you can muster to break away from hell and sin's grip, it won't be enough. You can't do it. Now, that's not to say it's impossible, because people have done it. We've seen it. Jesus says very clearly, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob are in heaven. But then, if you can't do it, but people have, how do you break out of hell's black hole? How do you escape sin's grasp? I think we all know the answer. Because someone came and someone did it for us. Jesus came, died on Calvary to break the curse of sin and death so that we can live eternally with him in heaven. And he did that for us. And Abraham and his journey of faith, they're proof of that. Because he got in. But see, that's the thing. Help oftentimes has to be accepted. It's there. It's waiting. But you can't use the power of Jesus' blood unless you take it. He's giving it, but you have to take it. Like Abraham did, you have to take that first step out your door into the path that he asked you to do, the path of salvation. And this morning we've looked at Abraham and his faith, his amazing journey, all the things that he did. Do you have faith in God? I assume you must have some, otherwise you wouldn't be here today. At least, if not faith, then some curiosity. But is it strong like Abraham's? Strong enough that if God asked you to, you would up and leave. Wander through the wilderness at the age of 75 and growing and counting with your family, just up and leave. I don't think many of us, if any of us, would. I know I wouldn't. There's too much keeping me in one spot. But how many of us have faith like that? How many of us have faith in God, strong like Abraham's? We're done with Abraham for now, but the topic of faith is so far from exhausted. Stories like his children and grandchildren of Isaac and Jacob, of Joshua and Caleb, of Joseph, people in the New Testament, even Jesus, Jonah, the story where Jonah failed. All of these are great, epic stories of faith that are amazing. And even if you don't study them, even if you don't read them continuously, just glance at them occasionally. The things they can show you are astounding. So please, continue studying and Faith isn't the only topic in the Bible. There are hundreds, thousands more. So look at them as well. But if you have any problems with your faith, or anything else really, please come now as we stand and as we sing.